Peace is hard to come by, in this world at least. Everybody has their own opinion about how you get peace. And ultimately, everybody wants peace. But isn't it crazy how we're willing to fight and have wars with other people to get it? And isn't that what most of our wars are fought about?
Peace in our time.
Yeah, because we want things to be better for us than they are now. It doesn't make a tremendous amount of sense. And I guess maybe that's because we don't really understand, perhaps, what truly brings peace. So let's take a look at really what I think is a strange passage that's going to give us a little insight into peace today. Luke 19, starting with verse 28. Luke 19, starting with verse 28. And I'm just going to read through so that we have the words in our minds. It says, after Jesus had said this, and that this is referring to the parable of the minas that we've looked at. It's been just a little while now as we've had some other things going on, but that the last time we had a sermon together, the parable of the minas was what he had just taught them. And says, after he had said this, he went on ahead going up to Jerusalem. As he approached Bethphage and Bethany, literally that's Figville and Dateville, at the hill called Olive Mountain, he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter it, you'll find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it, tell them, the Lord needs it. Those who were sent ahead went and found it just as he had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners asked them, why are you untying the colt? I imagine they didn't say it quite that nicely, but who knows. They replied, the Lord needs it. They brought it to Jesus and threw their cloaks on the colt and put Jesus on it. As he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road. When he came near the place where the road goes down to the Mount of, down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, rebuke your disciples. I tell you, he replied, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, if you, even you, had known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will come will build an embankment against you and encircle you and hem you in on every side. They will dash you to the ground, you and the children within your walls. They will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize, literally it says, the time of your visitation. A lot of strange things in here. Should we talk about some of the strange things? This is a story that, you know, those of us who've grown up with the Bible, we've heard and we've known since kids, and I just read it and I kind of go, oh yeah, all right, well, the triumphal entry, rode the donkey. But this is the strangest series of events. As he's getting close to these two villages, he sends two disciples ahead saying, oh, I want you to go into town on the side of the road. You'll find a VW parked there with the keys in it. Just get in and drive it back. Yeah, it's a brand new, right? Sitting there with the keys in it. Bring it back. Isn't that just a little bit odd? I mean, the first odd thing is that Jesus says, yeah, go on into the village, and he knows what they're going to find, right? That there's a particular colt that's never been ridden before, and it's going to be tied there. How in the world would he know that? They didn't have cell phones. He couldn't go on Google maps Street View, right, and get a look of the street and see, oh, yes, there's a donkey parked there. I suppose, in theory, he could have written a letter, snail mail, I think they had snail mail back then, and said to someone that he knew in Bethage or Bethany, please have an unbroken colt tied, you know, at the entrance of town at Passover time, because I'm coming and I'll need it. I mean, theoretically, it's possible, but you get the impression that that's not how he knew. That, at least from the disciples' perspective, they're going, now, wait a minute, we've been with him all the way from Galilee. We know he hasn't been into town yet. How could he know where a donkey is parked? Let alone that specific donkey. Definitely a little strange. And what good is a halter broke donkey, by the way? Anybody here work with equine creatures?
Donkeys.
What good is a halter broke donkey? Do you understand what I mean by that? On which no one has ever ridden. What's going to happen the first time someone gets on it? You're going to have a rodeo. So Jesus sends them, sight unseen, into the village to go bring back, it's halter broke, right, because it's tied, right? It can be led, but bring back a donkey that nobody's ever ridden on. Oh, I wonder what he's going to do with this donkey.
Standard.
Pardon?
I grew up with donkeys. It probably wouldn't do anything. He probably would just not.
Yeah, the donkey would just stand there. And why does Jesus want a donkey in the first place? I mean, this seems like an awful lot of hassle to go to get a donkey, particularly a green, unbroken donkey.
There's a prophecy.
He said there's a prophecy. Yes. And traditionally it was the Mount of Kings.
Yes.
There, some people say that way. You wouldn't know just off the top of your head the passage, so I will tell it to you. It's Zechariah 9, verse 9, that has a donkey being ridden by the Messianic king. And if you're familiar with Handel's Messiah, this passage will be at least partly familiar to you. It says, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Yes, we get a little recitation over here. Behold, your king is coming to you. He's endowed with salvation, humble, and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. It's that specific. I'm going to read verse 10, too, because it will be helpful for us. It goes on to say, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim. Now, what kind of horse draws a chariot? Or what kind of creature draws a chariot?
Horse.
Yeah, a horse. A full-blown war horse draws a chariot, not a donkey. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, or the war horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off, and he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea and from the river to the end of the earth. So part of the answer to the question, why did he want a donkey in the first place, is because it was prophesied. There was this messianic prophecy about the king coming riding on a donkey. But my other question is the same. Why does he want a donkey? What is the significance of the Messiah coming riding a donkey? Did you catch it from the Zechariah passage? What it means when Messiah shows up riding on a donkey?
Israel will be victorious. The enemy will be gone and vanquished.
Right. There is an age of peace inaugurated. Mm-hmm. Right. But notice...
Right.
And the king... Go ahead.
Well, and that sort of would indicate some royalty. Or something.
Yes. Yes. But what if he had decided to ride in on a war horse? How would that be different from riding in on a donkey? Yes, the emphasis here is this is the Messiah who comes bringing peace, not war. That's what the significance of it is. It's like coming in a VW bug versus riding in on a tank. Right? And don't great kings and military leaders who are coming do that? They send a message by how they arrive. I mean, I've seen, was it pictures of Fidel Castro with the revolution in Cuba, you know, riding in on a tank, hanging onto the barrel, standing on the... That's quite a different message from riding in on a donkey. And that's what it says here. Humble, mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, a baby. Now, you might, I suppose, you could get a miniature chariot and tow it behind a donkey, but not a baby donkey. Right? You don't take a foal into war. And so the message here is, I'm the messianic king, but I'm not coming to take over this nation by conquering it. If I'm going to be the king of this nation, it will be because you welcomed me peacefully as your rightful ruler. I'm not coming with violence. I'm not coming with coercion. I'm coming peacefully.
What is the significance of taking away the chariots from people?
This is what God is saying. When the messianic king comes, I will take away that it will be the end of war. You won't be attacked and destroyed anymore. I can send a king to you humbly, gently, because I will be keeping peace for you on every side. You won't have to fight. Yeah? This is the king coming to rule by persuasion. He conquers them with love instead of with violence. Untie it and bring it here. Wouldn't that be considered grand theft donkey? I mean, isn't it odd? He tells them, go on into town. When you find it, just untie it and bring it. Don't ask around for the owners. Don't, you know, look for the rental contract. Don't go down to U-Haul, rent a donkey. Pardon?
Don't buy it outright.
Yeah, don't buy it. Just go when you find it, untie it, and bring it. Mm-hmm. Why in the world would he do that? It seems to me like the surest way, when the owners see you in their car, driving out of the parking lot, to get arrested or at least stopped. And I mean, if somebody was in your car outside here, and they had started the car up and they were starting to drive away and you came out and stopped them and said, hey, whoa, wait a minute. What are you doing in my car? If they said to you, the Lord needs it, would you let them have your car?
What are you saying?
Yeah, exactly. I certainly wouldn't let them have my car. It seems like Jesus is setting them up for complete failure. You know, if they really want to successfully come back with a donkey, they should go to U-Haul and rent one, or to at least ask nicely, can we borrow this donkey? We'll get it back by 5 o'clock.
Wouldn't they have been familiar with the prophecy?
It's possible. It's possible. And I don't know why, but what was their response when the disciples said, the Lord needs it? They must have let him have it.
The Holy Spirit was talking to him.
It seems to be the case. I imagine that there were rumblings of what was going on. But it certainly doesn't seem like the best plan for success to me. Unless you want to communicate to your disciples that this was all planned, that it's inevitable, that this is not being humanly orchestrated. Why would he want his disciples to know that so badly at this point? In a very short time, 90% of what they believed about the Messiah, they're going to be disillusioned of. And he wants them to have as much in the 10% that's left that convinces them this man was from God. There's no other way we could explain the whole donkey thing. There's no other way we could explain the walking on water. There's no other way we could explain unless he was from God. They're going to need those things to make it through the disappointment that they're facing. And of course, we talked about this already, the maiden voyage. They bring the donkey to Jesus. He's Halterbrook, right? That part's not so confusing. They throw their coats on him. Well, what happens when you take an animal that's not been put under saddle yet and start putting things on its back? Yeah, you get all kinds of interesting reaction. Well, maybe this one had been sacked out already. Are you familiar with that term? Sacked out? Right, once an animal is halter broke, you take bags, sacks, whatever, and you kind of shake it up, and you get it desensitized to having things on its legs and around and on its back. It's called sacking out. So maybe this one had already been sacked out. So they throw their coats on it, and it's still calm. But when they put Jesus on it, the fact that he just gets on and rides away is nothing short of miraculous.
Mm-hmm. I always wondered how big this colt was. Didn't he look ridiculous, this big grown man on this old time?
Seems like it. You know, it had to be a big enough colt to carry a man. But yeah.
That donkey's
probably big to begin with. Well, it could have been, you know, what you'd consider sort of a teenager, like nearly full grown, but just not started under saddle. You know, hadn't been used for that yet. Although, if you think about it, it's not that shocking of a miracle. I mean, if Jesus really is the Creator, why can't he talk to the donkey? I mean, this is the same Jesus that made the donkey talk to his rider. Back in the story of Balaam. So why can't he talk to the donkey and say, hey, it's going to be fine. Just go with me on this one. Yeah. I suppose he could. It's got to be he's got to be the most incredible donkey whisperer there ever was. I mean, I've seen guys literally, you know, watch on TV a recording, start to finish, start a horse in 2 hours from halter broke to riding it, and, you know, no bucking, no kicking. When they learn how to communicate with the horse in a way that it understands, that can be done. But this was not 2 hours. This was, come, throw the blankets on, get on, and go. Well, then there's the behavior of the people. What do? When Jesus begins parading down the road on the donkey's back, they take off their clothes, their coats, and they begin spreading them on the ground for the donkey to walk on.
And palm fronds.
Pardon?
And palm fronds.
And palm fronds and whatever else they could find. But here it mentions the clothes specifically. Now, isn't that just a little bit odd?
Yeah, it must be how they did for King.
Well, we get intuitively, we kind of understand what this means, right? It's the red carpet treatment. But would you take off? I wouldn't take off my coat and lay it in this relatively clean street for a limousine to drive over. And they're taking off their clothes, which were a lot more valuable to them than mine are to me. You know, a lot harder to replace, a lot more expensive if you're talking about percentage of their income spent on them, and they're laying them in what kind of a street? Yeah, this is Roman times. It may have been paved with cobblestones, but it was dirty, right? Yeah. What kind of animal? What kind of vehicles are traveling this road? Donkeys and donkey carts.
Solid exhaust.
Maybe travel. Solid exhaust. Yeah, all right. Yeah. This is not a clean street. Right? This is not a pleasant place to be putting your clothes down for something that's been walking in this street to walk on. Besides, this is a mess. And I thought, well, this isn't really miraculous like some of the other things were. I mean, people taking off their clothes and setting them down. Then I got thinking about it a little bit more. Maybe it is. That's probably actually the biggest miracle we've seen so far. That human beings would take their valuables and lay them in the dust for Jesus. He didn't demand it. He didn't command it. Spontaneously, in recognition of who he was and the honor that he deserved, they took their best, the best things they had with them, and laid them down in the muck for Jesus. That's a bigger miracle than Jesus knowing where the donkey was. That's a bigger miracle than getting on and riding. That kind of transformation in the human heart does not happen every day. These are the faithful servants pictured in the parable of the minas, who understand that everything they have really belongs to the master, and it's at his disposal. These are the Zacchaeuses of the world versus the rich young rulers, who are more concerned with seeing Jesus and being with Jesus than with keeping their stuff and keeping it in good shape. Well, then something else strange happens. The crowd gets so excited, they start a party. And they're shouting and cheering, and they get so bold that they say, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And yikes! That really tweaks out one of the Pharisees in the crowd. You're going to let these people just call you king like that? How dare you? And he tells Jesus, "Rebuke your disciples. You can't let them say that and just receive that." And Jesus says, "If the people don't say it, the rocks will." Now that would be a miracle for sure. Have you ever met a talking rock? I'll take that as a no. Although I guess it's not totally unprecedented. In a little while, when Jesus is hanging on the cross, we're told that the sun hid its face. And the earth trembled. Because even though human beings didn't recognize what was happening here, inanimate nature knew the significance of what was going on. And it responded.
Well, were some of these people that were lauding him now, some of those that said crucify him?
I believe so. Jesus is essentially saying, "I am the King. And if people don't recognize it, the truth will be told, even if God has to give the rocks voices. It will be known." And right in the middle of this celebration, as he's parading along and people are crying out, "Hosanna, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord," and Jesus says, "This celebration is appropriate," right? It's not that he disapproves of it, but what does Jesus stop to do? Right in the middle of the celebration, he parks that donkey on the edge of the hill, and he just bursts into tears. Do people usually cry at parties?
Not for that reason.
They might cry over joy, but these are not tears of joy. If you could just say in general, I mean, have you ever been at a party and had to go out because you were about to cry? Or have you ever been with someone who had a hard time at a party or a celebration? Why do people cry at parties if it's not tears of joy? Can you give me any examples?
If it's a baby shower and someone wasn't able to have a child, they could feel the pain and want to leave.
When the celebration reminds someone of grief, it's not surprising if they cry at the party. Or if it's Christmas time and for the first time you're celebrating
without a son or a daughter or a husband,
and someone that you love is not there, then you cry at the celebration. So why is Jesus crying here? Does it fit? What does he say? How does he explain why he's crying?
He's crying over Jerusalem because they won't pay attention to him. And he's so sad. He wants them to come to him.
Yes. He says, if you, Jerusalem, and it's the plural you, he's speaking to the people of Jerusalem, or to Jerusalem kind of personified as the people. If you had known this day, even you, the things which make for peace. But now they've been hidden from your eyes, for the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Why is he upset?
They rejected him.
And why is that sad for him in this context?
They're throwing a big party thinking he's going to be the king and bring prosperity and rulership and all that. And they totally miss the point. And he's going, he's seen the pain. He's seen the murder. He's seen the blood. He's seen all that coming. And the people have the view of prosperity, and he's seeing the view in the near future of...
Oh, wow. Of war and death. He's upset because they're going to be destroyed. That there's nothing stopping it. Wow. Say that again.
There's nothing stopping it, not even him. It's like he's realizing that.
Not even him. That he has done everything that he could possibly do to give peace to these people. And they do not recognize him. They do not recognize what's going on. They will not receive the peace offering that he is bringing. He's upset because they're blundering on blindly to their own destruction, and he loves them. And he doesn't want them to go, but even he can't stop it from happening. If you had only known what brings you peace. Everybody wants peace. But I'll fight you if what you think brings peace is different from what I think brings peace. And if you come along and say, this is the path to peace and I don't want to go on that path, I'll kill you. Now, who was right? Was Jesus' path to peace the right way, or was their path to peace the right way? Jesus' path to peace was the right way. And he knew that they would get the war that they wanted. and that they would be totally wiped out in it. Interestingly, those who received Jesus' message of peace, the people that believed in him, all of them escaped from the destruction of Jerusalem, which is what he's talking about here when he says not one stone will be left on another. AD 70, amid mere 40 years or so after this, 35 or 40 years. If you had only understood what brings peace, maybe we could think of it this way. Jesus is the envoy of peace from heaven, the ambassador. Right? Because there is a war coming to this planet, which is going to wipe out all of the enemies of peace. In the parable of the minas, we heard about it, right? The king receives a kingdom and he goes away, and when he comes back, he says, those enemies of mine, come and kill them in front of me. There is a war that's going to end all wars. But you don't have to be caught up in that war if you make peace with the envoy in advance. God knows that he's coming with the war to end all wars, but he says, I'm offering you the palm branch of peace in advance. And anybody who will settle with me out of court, anybody who will make peace with me now, will not be swept away in the destruction that is to come. But what is their response to the envoy of peace? He's come with this white flag all the way from heaven. They seize him. They're suspicious. They take him and they slaughter him. I mean, that's the worst, the lowest of the low kind of war crime you can think of. Someone was telling me they just read some of the history of the Modoc Wars here. And that in one of the stories that goes around was that Captain Jack showed up at this peace treaty and slaughtered the general. And well, the rest of the story is that when the settlers first arrived, they arranged a peace gathering and killed Captain Jack's father and so I guess that's what he thought you'd do at a peace meeting. Treachery. Jesus is not grieving here that he's going to be killed. That's why he came. He's not grieving that he's going to lay down his life. He's not hurting over the rejection. Oh, my poor heart, they don't like me. He's grieving because their decision is going to lead to their destruction. And he's going to miss them. He loves them and he wants them to be with him in eternity. Amen. And they don't understand that he's come offering peace. That they don't need to go there. That they could make peace now. Well, peace is kind of invisible. Right? He says you don't know what makes for peace because it's hidden from your eyes. Well, you can't see peace. I guess it makes some sense that it's hidden from them. It's invisible. But then again, on the other hand, I mean, here's this peace parade going down the road with the king on the donkey. It's not like they couldn't have seen it if they'd been willing to. What do they think will bring peace?
Throw out the Romans.
Some of them. As I was thinking about this, I realized there's really two classes, and the people that do him in actually had a different view of what would bring peace. They thought they already had peace. The Roman Empire was not a really bad place to live. We always hear from the perspective of the poor Jews in the Gospels how horrible Roman oppression was, and they want to kick them out and everything. But have you ever heard of the Pax Romana? The Roman peace? Rome was such a powerful empire that they pushed war out to the borders. And the people who lived in the center of the empire enjoyed peace for a period of several hundred years. Now, for our Earth's history, that's really unique. I mean, we've gone from war to war to war to war down through history, everybody trying to get one up on the next guy. And so the people who were doing well financially, who were prosperous, were scared that Jesus would come and upset the peace that they already had. If this guy declares himself king, then the Romans are going to come and they'll crush us and they'll take away our nation. They already had peace and the status, and they wanted the status quo. They were the conservatives. Don't change anything on us. But you know, that wasn't real peace. Because some people were down in the bottom of that and they weren't happy. And war was brewing one way or another. But see, the path to peace can't be through war, because all that happens is I trade places with you. And now I'm on top and you're oppressed. And give it enough time and gets bad enough, and then you'll fight with me and I'll be... So what is it that Jesus was bringing that really brings peace?
Love, forgiveness, rightness with God.
A miracle on the inside that allows us to love each other instead of just trying to get one up on the other person. The kind of love that would go and sacrifice myself in order to make peace with you. That's what Jesus was bringing. That's what the donkey was bringing into town, was self-sacrificing love. The only way to real peace. And they wouldn't have it. It was a threat to the peace that they already, the peace that they already enjoyed. Everybody wants peace. On their own terms. And apparently, if you want to bring real peace, what kind of a response can you expect? Resistance, violence, hate and anger. I have to tell a story. I believe, biblically speaking, the only way to have real peace is to having a, is to have a loving authority to whom everyone offers their obedience. Does that make sense? Right. The only way to have real peace is for everyone to be right with God. Then we can be right with each other. Then we can live together in harmony. And so you've got to have a loving authority figure who conducts the peace. Well, it works in your house the same way. Right? If kids do not experience their parents as a loving authority figure, there will be no peace in the home. And that applies whether the parents are just overbearing and not loving, or whether they're not an authority figure. And I was just listening to a story this week about a 15-year-old who was absolutely obnoxious with his mom. Every time they got in the car, he would start bad-mouthing her, and she couldn't do anything about it because they're driving in the car. And he knew it, and he was in trouble. Stop and tune him up. Yes. Well, her way of handling it was, you better get a civil tongue in your mouth. You're not going to speak to me that way. If you keep talking to me that way, you're going to get out and walk. And so she'd pull over and he'd get out. She'd start driving down the road and feel guilty, wonder kidnappers were going to come and get him. So she'd pull off the side of the road and wait for him to get back in, and she'd say, I hope you learned your lesson. I mean business. She got down the road 10 minutes and realized he's not wearing his seatbelt. What is she experiencing? resistance, all right? She's trying her best to be this authority figure and to lead the family to peace. But it's not working. And he's... So she begins the seatbelt lecture. Have you ever heard the seatbelt lecture? Ever given the seatbelt lecture? You better get that seatbelt on. What if we got a crash? You'd be flying through the front window. You'd be all broken up. Then you'd be sorry. I don't care. It's my body. So what can she do? There's no peace. So she says, well, I'm not real happy with this. I guess I'm going to have to do something about it. And just drops it. I get home, and 2 or 3 days later, he says, Mom, Stephen just called. I'm going to go over to his house. We're going to work on his motorcycle, and we'll go riding. Can you take me? Oh, this is so sad. I'll be happy to take you places when I'm not worried about you mouthing off in the car. What kind of reaction do you think she got?
Promise.
Oh, Mom, I didn't mean it the other day. I just forgot to take my medication. Oh, I know. And I'll be happy to take you places when I'm not worried about a hassle. This isn't fair. This is the stupidest thing. And he goes off into his room. World War III erupts. Punches a big hole in the wall. Well, now what's she going to do? Go in there and lecture him. Now you know this is no way to behave. You're going to start treating me better and take care of this house. No. Mom has got peace inside, finally. And she realizes that anger and lectures only fuel the misbehavior. If you want to bring peace outside, you've got to have peace inside first. So she says, this is no problem. We can handle this. And so after he's calmed down, he gets to learn about drywall repair. And pay for it with his own money. Only, he wasn't really interested in paying for it with his own money. So she says, no problem. I'll take care of it. We'll handle that later. He comes home the next day and discovers his bike is missing. What happened to my bike? Where's my bike? What'd you do with my bike? Oh, this is so sad. You know, Mr. Smith down the street, the big farmer guy, he's agreed to act as our pawnbroker. I had to take your bike down to get the money to pay the drywall guy. But don't worry, it's no problem. As long as you pay him this much money, by this date, you can get your bike back. This is so stupid, I'm calling the sheriff. You can't take my stuff and give it to some guy down the street. So he calls the sheriff. And Mom's thinking, oh no. You know, I didn't think about this. What's going to happen? Am I going to be in trouble? The good news is she bought the bike. So she can take it and pawn it if she wants to. If he bought the bike, then that might be grand theft bicycle. And the sheriff comes, and Mom's sitting in the house just going, oh, I hope this goes well. I don't know what's going to happen here. And she sees him talking, smiling with the boy. And finally, she sees him sticking out his hand to shake her son's hand. And she hears some of the first words of the conversation that she's heard through the cracked door. And this is in the South. Well, son, looks like you're going to have to start listening to your mom. You know, he didn't continue the behavior much after that. Maybe a few outbursts. It gets worse before it gets better on the path to peace. But Jesus is going to get us to peace.
Whether we're having peace with him or whether we're crushed as a result of the war.
He's going to get us to peace. Anyone who's willing to go. And he doesn't like it. It's not pleasant. He's sad. But those who choose against peace, it would be absolute torture for him to keep them alive and force them to live without peace for the rest of eternity. And so he lets them choose, even though he would love to do something about it. Even he cannot stop people from choosing destruction over peace. What do we think will bring us peace? People in this day and age in America. What are some of the things that people think will bring them peace? Money, things, yes.
Education.
That's, yeah, potentially.
Technology.
Technology. Stuff.
Bars and walls.
What were you going to say, Sharon?
The we.
The we?
The we.
The relationship?
No.
Oh, the we. Yes, the technology. Computer games. Entertainment. Power? Do any of those things really bring peace?
No.
Not lasting peace anyway.
No.
Oh, look at the result of power this last week.
Mm.
If that did anything for peace. Never mind. Oh, my God. Oh, man, what a mess.
Peace must be on the inside first. You can't get peace from anything outside except Jesus and Him putting it inside. Peace must be on the inside first. And people who have received the peace that Jesus offers on the inside can have a powerful effect on the outside. Get resistance. But if you know where you're going and why you're going there, you can say, you know what? It's okay, because I've got a peace that nobody can take away from me on the inside. You need peace? There's an envoy from heaven who'd be happy to talk with you about it. He's offering it free. If you want to make peace with Him and have peace from now through eternity, it's freely available. All you do is say, Jesus, I recognize You as the King. I want the peace You have to offer. I know I can't get it from any other place.